This is Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today's program looks at teacher education programs and their effectiveness. Currently, their value is under attack by critics who claim colleges of education do not prepare teachers for actual classrooms. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan stated recently, "The current system that prepares our nation's teachers offers no guarantee of quality for anyone." The Department of Education is proposing three new measures on which it would require education schools to report: how much their graduates help students to learn, whether teacher candidates are placed in high-need subjects and areas, and whether school administrators are satisfied with the quality of program graduates. Here to give us some historical perspective about teacher education and its general standing is David Labery, Professor of Education at Stanford University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Elizabeth. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's your own interest and experience with the history of teacher education?
Well, I kind of backed into it. I was never a real teacher myself. My only teaching experience is at the college level. And I had a degree in sociology. I was looking for a job. I couldn't find a sociology job, and a college of education is the one that offered me one. So I found myself at Michigan State in the mid-1980s, and that was a place where teacher education was at the very center of the intellectual life of the college. And the college was going through, the dean at that time, Judy Lanier, was running a group called the Holmes Group, which was trying to reinvent teacher education for the country. So I got a very quick education in what teacher ed meant, what an ed school is, and found myself getting inducted into the world of teacher ed, which I've been in ever since.
I know you've written a book on that topic too, right?
Yes, The Trouble with Ed Schools.
Right.
Not the most uplifting title, but it's a history that has had lots of problems in it.
Well, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of its history?
Yeah, it's a, schools in this country didn't start emerging in a large scale until the 1830s. Before that, schools were small, local, somewhat haphazardly organized, and teachers were typically men, and they did it as a temporary job. Often it was college students who would use teaching as a holding pattern until something better came along. And so not exactly a great model for launching a school system. And so in the 1830s, the beginnings of the Common School movement kick in, which were a movement to create universal public education for all students at the elementary level across the country, and started in the Northeast and moved quickly across country. And so at that point, suddenly you have large numbers of classrooms. You're going to need large numbers of teachers. It's going to be a very expensive operation, and you have to find some mechanism for producing them and not just rely on people doing it part-time until something better came along. And so at that point, two things happened to teaching that were quite dramatic. One is it turned very quickly from a man's job to a woman's job, in part because women were available and in part because women were cheap. If you're going to scale up a large-scale system and women were willing to work half price teaching, half price that men were charging, that looked like a good economic model. And so it's shifted to women, and the Common School founders, people like Horace Mann and Henry Barnard and others, invented normal schools, teacher training institutions that were state-operated. Their job was to get up to speed quickly a large number of teachers to fill these brand-new classrooms around the country. It was basically a high school equivalent institution, a normal school was. That was providing as much subject matter training, giving a kind of mini high school education to teachers who had just come out of grammar school and then a little bit of teacher pedagogy, and then boom, send them out into the classroom. Mm-hmm. So that's where teacher ed started. It started with the normal school, and it's been a long, somewhat circuitous route since then.
Oh, what about the movement to make it more professional?
That was part of the original mission of the normal school. And you read some of the statements of the founders and the ideals of the early leaders of these institutions. They really wanted to make this a professional training program and not simply a quick way to supply teachers for the classroom. The problem was that they needed huge numbers, and the normal schools, in effect, had a choice. They could have been a very intense, high-level professional program that would have produced a relatively small number of teachers, and most teachers would have come into teaching through some other mechanism that where they would be much more poorly prepared. And so they basically made the choice, instead of aiming for high professionalism, they aimed for making themselves relevant. And so normal school kept itself, as an easy route in. It was a short program. It was not terribly demanding. It was not very expensive. It was not very selective. But it was able to accommodate large numbers of students. And so that was they opted for something like a teacher factory model rather than a professional school.
Uh-huh. Did the curriculum differ from state to state? In other words, like the emphasis on, say, pedagogy or on academic subject matter?
It was pretty rudimentary. Most of the instruction that went on in normal schools was actually simply teaching people the subject matters they were going to be teaching later on. And the amount of pedagogy involved was less about the kind of things we think about today, the psychological techniques for enhancing learning and promoting student engagement in learning. The issue was much more rudimentary. It was school keeping, how to manage the kids, how to keep them quiet, how to work through a curriculum, how to grade tests, and how to present lessons, but it didn't go much beyond that.
Well, do you see any changes from then to now?
Yeah, a long series of changes, because by the an interesting phenomenon happened that was that for a lot of people, especially for a lot of women, the normal school was a state-subsidized form of higher education that often wasn't available elsewhere, and it was very inexpensive compared to going to a private college or even to the local state university. And so it became it drew lots of students, particularly women, as a way of getting a good education and as an alternative to higher education. And so the issue was that as more people came in, the demand from the students was not just to be prepared to be a teacher, but to be getting the kind of education you could get at a college, more of a liberal arts education, where you could specialize in teaching if you wanted, but where you were offered broader opportunities. They wanted something less like a teacher factory and more like a people's college. And American higher ed then and now is very sensitive to consumers, because consumer tuition, student tuition, is a huge factor. And so normal schools had to adapt to student demands. If they didn't, the competitor down the road would do so. And so they started branching out and offering a wider range of programs. And by the end of the 19th century, they were gradually turning into teacher colleges instead of high school equivalent normal schools. Teacher colleges with a wide array of programs. By the 1920s and 30s, they started to drop the word teachers from their name and started calling themselves just a state college. And by the 1960s, they were transforming themselves into universities. So most of the regional state universities in this country, I mean, in California, the whole California state university system emerged originally from a collection of local normal schools that gradually evolved into teachers' colleges, state colleges, and then finally a state university system. In Michigan, it was Eastern, Western, Northern, and Central Michigan University. They were all normal schools originally and are now regional state universities. So there was a real fascinating kind of upward mobility that teacher education followed. It started out as a kind of vocational school at the high school level for teachers alone, and they ended up as full-service regional universities by the 100 years later.
Well, what do you see as the major disagreements about teacher ed that repeatedly surface?
Well, you can see from that history some problems that arise, and that is, here was an institution that was founded purely to train teachers, and then by the end of this period, it was a full-service university that had education as just one of the options. And so teacher ed started out as the central mission, and it became increasingly peripheral over time. So that's been a problem because the when you think about it, the learning how to teach involves both learning your subject matter and learning the craft and psychology and methods of teaching those subject matters. And that universe, that responsibility spread across the entire institution. Now, in a normal school, that was fine because everybody was going to be a teacher. But if you're attending one of the regional state universities now and you're a teacher candidate, you learn your math in the math department and your English in the English department. And what you learn in the School of Education is the pedagogy part, only one part of the whole. So there's a very diffuse responsibility, and in some ways it's the ed school is the only one that is really focused on the teacher ed mission, but the subject matter knowledge components of teacher training are actually held by faculty and departments elsewhere on campus. So that's created a kind of a sense that nobody is quite owns teacher ed. In some ways it's owned by the entire institution, but in some ways by nobody. And the part that the ed school plays is the part that often subject matter departments consider peripheral. They say, hey, we teach the subject. That's what they're supposed to teach. All you do over there is teach classroom management and blackboard erasing and how to keep roll, you know. So what's the big deal? It's like, we've got the core of it. What you do is marginal and intellectually not very interesting.
It's interesting how they've gone from the center of the education to the periphery and are held in very low repute, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very it's a peculiar history that is still stamps the organization. So you find this strange pattern where universities have, teacher education ended up in the university basically by accident rather than by plan. It started outside, and then the teacher ed institutions themselves evolved into universities. So it wasn't anybody's ambition. It was more what the consumers, the students themselves, wanted. And so at the end of this, you get a pattern where the actual preparation of teachers is one that is not central to the institution anymore, and it's also low on the status order. You know, the status order puts the disciplines at the top, and field like education is seen as being not terrifically prestigious. Part of it's that history, you know, we kind of came in from left field. Part of it is the sense that people often feel that teaching is not really a profession. It's just child care, and anybody could do it who had the right personality. So, you know, calling it a profession often in the public mind and in the minds of colleagues across campus seems a little inflated, you know.
But now there's been such criticism saying you're not producing effective teachers. There ought to be a better way of doing it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? So it's nice. In some ways, ed schools are very convenient to have because it's good to have somebody to blame, you know. And it's an easy target because it's a low prestige target. It's understood that this is a natural place to point to. And so we end up getting blamed for the problem, and we're supposed to try to do something about it. But the main solution is often not to improve teacher preparation, but to actually bypass it. You hear all of the programs now. Teach for America is a hugely successful program that basically bypasses teacher preparation. So you get a quick training during the summer of maybe 4 weeks, and then you take some classes during the year, but you plunge into the classroom at the end of that first summer as a full-time teacher responsible for a class. So that's one route. You know, a lot of cities like New York City have, they call it a teaching fellows program. Again, they run their own quick access to teaching that bypasses teacher ed. And so you see lots of efforts like that. The KIPP schools are now developing their own teacher preparation alternative. And so often the issue seems to be, we blame the schools of education, but we consider them incorrigible. And so the only way to deal with them is to, you know, skirt around them, find another route to get good people into teaching.
Well, what do you see as future developments in teacher education?
It's hard to know. I'm a historian, not a futurist, so I'm not really anxious to be talking about the future. But you can see the kind of extension of trends right now. The pressure building to look for alternative routes. That's been a kind of chronic pressure for teacher ed over the years. But now we're seeing, you know, a lot of efforts to work around teacher ed. And so, you know, we see efforts for change coming from a variety of places. There are, you know, the Arne Duncans of the world and others who have been pushing to say we really need to transform the whole model of how we think about preparing teachers if we're going to be changing schools. Teacher is the mantra of the current reform movement, is that the teacher is the key element, and so it's crucial how you shape and that teacher, what kind of training they have, how you select them, and how you what kind of incentives you provide them. So we're shifting toward trying to be more selective. So the Teach for America model, for example, and the New York Teaching Fellows model is one that says basically teachers are born, not made. It's not something you're trained into. We just pick smart, well-educated people and then induce them to become teachers. But the actual teacher education part of it is not terribly important. It's more a matter of selection than socialization. So that's a route that increasingly is going to marginalize teacher education if that model persists. Education part of it is not terribly important. It's more a matter of selection than socialization. So that's a route that increasingly is going to marginalize teacher education if that model persists.
Thank you, David. That was David Labarie, professor of education at Stanford University. Up next, we talk to a professor at the University of Michigan who is hoping their framework for teacher education will soon become the national model. This is Examining Education. This is Examining Education. Our next guest is Deborah Ball, Dean of the University of Michigan School of Education, as well as a faculty member in the department. Welcome, Dean Ball. Can you tell us about your own experiences in the field of teacher preparation?
Well, my earliest experience was being trained as a teacher myself. I was trained at Michigan State University in the mid-1970s, and I became an elementary classroom teacher. And at that time, I was already aware that there were many views about what would best prepare a teacher, and I participated in a program that was called an intern program, in which I had coursework and a lot of experience working carefully in classrooms with a lot of supervision, and then I had an entire year in which I was an intern teacher responsible for a group of children, but with close supervision and making less than a regular teacher's salary. So that was my earliest experience, and I have spent time since then thinking about what that did and did not prepare me to do. And then I taught for many years, taught elementary school, and became interested in the question about what best helps people to learn to teach, and gradually became interested in that question beyond my own efforts to improve my own teaching, and began studying how teacher preparation programs try to teach teachers, what they learn from that, what people already know about teaching before they begin any training, what they know when they leave their formal training. And I did research on this, and I also was more and more actively, as I went back to school and got a doctorate, and I began also teaching teachers more formally, both practicing teachers through professional development and also on campus in teacher preparation programs. And since then, I've continued to be someone who teaches teachers in teacher preparation, and most recently have led an effort here at the University of Michigan, where I'm now on the faculty, in which we redesigned our entire program around practice, that is to center the program such that those who participate in the program are working to learn specific tasks and activities that they'll have to carry out as teachers. Rather than learning a lot of ideas about teaching, they're actually learning to do the clinical skills involved in the work. So that's a short version of my, what is now actually about over 30 years of experience, both as a being prepared and then teaching teachers and then beginning to think as a designer about the problems of teacher education and how they could be remedied.
So what do you think is required to be effective?
First, that I'd like to put in the front, which I think most people would agree with, but I want to emphasize that a particular way of thinking about it is one needs clinical training to become an effective teacher. That is, one needs to have ample opportunity to be practicing the core skills of teaching under close supervision with very careful, focused, detailed feedback. I don't think that, for example, just spending time in schools with children is adequate to learn the practice, but many people would agree with me that one needs, quote, experience to learn to teach, and I'm saying essentially that that experience needs to be structured and supervised, that many people have experience in teaching and they learn things that actually are not productive of effective teaching. For example, you might learn by working with children that some children have a great deal of difficulty learning to read, and you might conclude from that that some children are much more, much unable to learn complex content. That would be a bad kind of learning. It's actually not true. So in order to work, to learn how to work with children who pose different kinds of challenges in learning, you need careful training to develop the repertoire of skills that permit you to be successful with every one of your learners. So thinking that people will figure that out simply by hanging out in classrooms or by being put in charge of a classroom, worse still, is really fallacious. And one doesn't learn any other complex skills that way. One doesn't learn to fly a plane by being given a plane and asked to figure out how you land and take off. One is given training. And so the first big category is focused, careful, supervised experience in schools. And I would conclude that as an ongoing necessity. Even once one is a teacher, it's important to continue to have opportunities to be have other people watch your teaching, talk to you about it in detail, provide careful feedback on aspects of your practice that you could improve. So supervised clinical practice coupled with feedback and guidance is crucial.
Well, now who does the supervision?
That's a very good question. Ideally, it should be somebody who themselves has skill in this area, but it may not be the most important thing. What's most important is that somebody do it who has training for how to provide that kind of feedback. So, for instance, if you came and watched me teach, and you had no preparation to do that, and you watched the class, you would undoubtedly have comments to be made. You might say, I really like the way you explained the task, or you might say, I noticed that some of the children were really engaged. None of that would qualify as focused feedback. I would need you to be there and be able to say, the sequence in which you called on students left this corner of the room uncalled on for several minutes, and I don't know whether you had reasons for that, but could we review the video now, and I'd like you to talk through the decisions you were making about who got a turn to talk and link that to your content purposes. And from doing that and having that conversation with a person who knew enough to ask me those questions, I would next time improve my ability to manage 25 or 35 children while I was conducting a discussion in my math teaching. Whereas if you just said your task was nice and the kids seemed engaged, that's nice, but it's really off the professional kind of level of detail that I would need to improve my teaching. Now, who can provide that? I think people can learn to do that, and they may not all be people who teach well themselves. For instance, professional tennis players are coached all the time by people who aren't as good tennis players as the players themselves. But what they have is the capacity to watch tennis playing very carefully and to have a vocabulary and a skill of watching that allows them to give very, very careful coaching. So coaching we use every day as a word, but actually very good coaching is extremely skillful kind of work. And what I'm describing is analogous to that kind of coaching. Somebody who knows the work, knows how to break it down into components that you can provide feedback on, and can watch teaching or watch records of teaching and provide that kind of feedback to a teacher. So all of that is still in the first category of what you asked me is what do you need, and I'm saying what you need is guided practice with very focused feedback on core elements of the work.
Right. I'm looking at my own background. I found that I didn't have the supervision, and I was placed with teachers who were not the greatest teachers. They were not great models. And then when I was supervising student teachers, I found that we were just anxious to find some teacher who would let the student be in their classroom. There were not enough teachers to place our students, and so our students were often with poor teachers and picked up poor lessons from that. The real question is, how do you get these supervisors? Are they provided by your program? Are they the cooperating teachers? Are they in the schools?
They could be all of those people. In our program, we work with teachers in schools whom we've selected to work with our interns. We also have people on our faculty, both tenure-track faculty and also faculty who work entirely in instruction. And those people are people with high levels of skill around this. And we deliberately provide professional training for people to do this. So we work with the mentor teachers and with our own staff to develop these observational guides and practice giving feedback. We have reduced the number of teachers with whom our interns work so that our interns can go in clusters to classrooms of teachers who have high levels of skill in particular parts of the work. For example, I'm teaching a course right now on classroom management skills, and we have selected teachers who have very high levels of capability around the way that they operate their classrooms, the kind of culture they've created, the routines that they've implemented, and the way their classrooms function. And when I have my interns observe in groups of three or four in these classrooms, and then we get back together to discuss what kinds of things we see the teachers doing, it's a much more strategic use of for this component of our program, a much more strategic use of classrooms. Later, when they themselves need to be practicing those routines later in the week, we have them in other classrooms with teachers who are good at providing feedback. Their environment may not be exactly the same as the ones where we observed, but there, too, we often have interns in pairs in classrooms so that they can watch each other and provide each other with guidance and feedback, as well as getting feedback from their supervisors. But by doing this grouping and clustering of interns, we're able to be more selective for particular purposes about where we place our interns in order to have experiences both watching accomplished practice and learning to do it.
How do you think applicants for a teaching program should be screened?
That's a great question. I think that we know far too little about the attributes that create high-quality learners of teaching, people who can learn well from their training and who can become skilled teachers. And so we default to things that I think make teacher education sound respectable. So you wouldn't, for example, want to be on record as saying it doesn't matter if people had you know, straight A's in their academic coursework. It would sound as though you didn't think it was important for people to know content. So it would be a very high-risk thing to say, we're not going to hold grade point average as one of the screening mechanisms. It would be just a very high-risk statement. However, if you're honest about it, grade point average in academic subjects is not a predictor whatsoever of whether a teacher is capable in making the content learnable by students. It's not even necessarily a prerequisite. In the research we've done on mathematics teacher knowledge, for example, there's no correlation between the level of attainment of a teacher in mathematics, the success they've had in college-level mathematics, and their ability to teach mathematics effectively. I can think of a number of test questions that would give me a much better estimate of their content knowledge than whether they have a high GPA or mm-hmm. whether their test scores on the GRE, if it's a master's program, are high. So we're at a moment in history where it's time for us to bite the bullet and name what we mean by content knowledge for teaching and assess that. We also should be asking questions about perseverance, about traits that have to do with being able to stick with the commitment to helping kids learn. Teach for America, for example, has gone very far in identifying some traits that they believe that you can assess for and that predict somebody's ability to have the kind of stick-to-itiveness that teaching requires, the kind of hard work ethic that teaching requires. And I think that's a very important pathway for us as a profession to be exploring. That said, I do want to say that I think the most important problem isn't screening for entry, but screening for exit. And actually, screening is not the right word for what I mean, but I rather would say I'd rather see the teacher preparation enterprise become much more strict about who exits any kind of training before they're permitted to practice responsibly. I'd be in favor of being somewhat permissive about who is allowed to enter a training program and much less permissive about who's allowed to have a license to teach. So if I had to pick the place I'd put my bets right now, I'd work on exit requirements, not entrance requirements.
Is this just something in theory, or is there any place where this is put into practice?
We are actually developing a set of performance assessments that will be used throughout our program. In fact, they already are being, and that we will ultimately have a set that we can hang our hat on that we will use for exit. So, for example, at the end of the first year of our undergraduate elementary program last year, the interns performed a set of performance assessments that we used to evaluate their progress in the program up to that point. And they represented the range of work that the interns had been engaged with across the year. They weren't tied one-to-one to a particular course or field experience, but rather they exemplified the performances we thought that they should have developed by the end of the first half of the program. People who didn't do well enough received additional instruction, were told that they hadn't done well enough, and were given additional opportunities to improve their performance. In the future, we will undoubtedly allow people to take those assessments twice with intermediate remedial work, but we will arrive at a standard where if someone fails those assessments twice, they won't be allowed to continue. And we are currently building the assessments that they will use to exit the program. We're also launching a national organization here called Teaching Works that will work nationally with other organizations that both prepare teachers or support them in schools in their early years. And we will be endeavoring to build those assessments collectively so that it's more than a University of Michigan project, but rather one that the profession in general will be building, where the point will be that teachers and those who prepare teachers will take a position that we no longer think it's acceptable for people to try out their wings on real children, but rather we'll agree on a core set of practices and have assessments that measure those. And we're well along the way to planning that project, to identifying the practices we think should be those mm-hmm. requirements and beginning to build prototypes of the assessments.
So then you're hoping that with this kind of preparation, there'd be lower dropout rates of teachers once they start teaching?
That's a very good point. I mean, I think partly what happens now is people are let loose to try out their teaching skills. They find themselves to be both frustrated and unsuccessful, and it doesn't take much thinking to realize why somebody would drop out. I mean, no one wants to continue doing something, particularly something that one thinks is important, and doing it poorly. So we do know in the attrition data on teachers that one very large reason they leave is because they don't feel that they're doing well, and they feel that their ability to do well is compromised by the environment and by their skill level.
Where do you see teacher preparation going in the next few years?
I hope where it will be going is toward a greater emphasis on performance expectations and assessment, and much more collective work across types of teacher preparation organizations and school districts to work together on a core set of teaching practices. You know, the country has recently tried to start agreeing that we can name the mathematical practices and content and the English language arts practices and content that children should learn. That's a huge tidal wave of change for this country. And my argument is that we can follow with a similar argument for teacher preparation and training, which is we can agree, I hope, on a core set of teaching practices and capabilities and kinds of knowledge that are directly related to improving kids' learning, and that there we could see collective work on building assessments, curriculum, training materials, and as you mentioned earlier, training for trainers, such that we would get out of the completely non-systematic way we have currently of preparing teachers, which consists of thousands of providers and thousands of programs and no agreements about outcomes. It's really embarrassing, and I hope that we can use the current enthusiasm for more collective common work and extend that into the professional training of teachers.
Thank you, Dean Ball. That was Deborah Ball from the University of Michigan School of Education. In a moment, we talk to an outspoken critic of the way institutes currently run teacher preparation programs. I'm Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley, and this is Examining Education. This is Examining Education. Today's topic is teacher education. Here now to share with us his criticisms of the current state of teacher education and give us his suggestions for improvement is Arthur Levine. He's currently the sixth president of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation. Before his appointment at Woodrow Wilson, Levine was president and professor of education at Teachers College, Columbia University. Among his publications is a series of reports critical of the preparation of teachers and administrators. Welcome, Dr. Levine.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell us about your own experience with teacher preparation and teacher preparation programs.
Sure. I was, as you noted, I was president of Teachers College for 12 years, and I studied teacher education all around America, which meant that we surveyed the deans of education schools, the alumni of education schools, the faculty of education schools. In addition, we looked at all the major statistics in terms of test scores, in terms of student performance, and so on and so forth, and looked at the demographics of education schools. And we conducted visits to about 40 education schools. So we had a mountain of data.
What did you find from this data?
My conclusion was that there are some excellent teacher education programs in America, but most are not doing well. They're not as good as they need to be. The quality varies from mediocre to terrible. And the reasons for that were, one, we don't agree in America on how you prepare teachers. I don't know any other profession in which you can enter the profession by taking a minor in the field as an undergraduate, or a major in teaching, or a major in some other subject area in college, or you can take a graduate program leading to a master's degree or a certification, or you can take some alternative route. Mm-hmm. We certainly don't have those kinds of arrangements for a law school or medical school. In addition, we found that the curriculums are weak. We found that there was little connection between clinical experience, the time people spend in schools, and the theory they're taught at education schools. We found that the quality of clinical experiences varied dramatically. We found schools in which students had to find their own placement, and they ended up in failing schools with failing teachers as their role models learned how to become teachers. We found that the research was poor,
admission standards were very low, as were graduation standards. And finally, that the quality of the faculty was such that they frequently hadn't had contact with schools in many years. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it was perfect.
It certainly sounds like a lot of problems. So what solutions do you propose?
I think there are several things that need to happen. One is, we really need to close down bad education schools and invest in quality schools. And that's not an abstraction. Every state in the union has the ability to reauthorize the teacher education programs in their state. More than that, this is the time to do it. We were told in the past that it wasn't possible because we needed so many new teachers. But right now, we're laying off teachers. We're not hiring that many outside of the science, math, English as a second language, and special education fields. So we can afford to cut the supply and thereby reduce numbers. We need to raise accreditation, which is the self-policing that occurs in the profession. So far, it's been very, very weak and hasn't been adequate for what we need. We need to raise admission standards.
Well, now, there's actually a difference of opinion about admission standards. Some people feel that if you raise admission standards, then you won't be encouraging diversity. What's your take on that?
I think there are really two cuts on this one. I have seen schools around the country that had very modest admission standards, but had very, very strong program standards. And the result is, although they took weaker students, they graduated very strong students. So it's possible to compensate in part for lower standards by very strong programs. But we're talking about modestly less strong programs. Mm-hmm. I've been to other institutions where they admitted students who couldn't possibly succeed. No chance whatever. That's not acceptable.
Well, why were they doing that?
Teacher education is what's called a cash cow. It generates a lot of money, particularly if done badly. And that creates a revenue stream for universities that they can invest in programs that are far more prestigious.
Well, I don't quite understand. Why don't their regular programs give them so much money? Why teacher ed?
Let's take doctoral programs in physics. Those are really expensive, and they have very few students. In contrast, teacher education is what you call a high-volume area with low cost to administer. So high-volume areas with low cost generate lots and lots of money. Low-volume, high-cost programs need to be supported.
Well, what makes them so cheap to administer?
Yeah, let's go back to that physics example for a second. And what we'd say about it is that the students in the program are largely on fellowships, so they're supporting the students. They're buying very, very expensive equipment, and the faculty are very high-priced. In contrast, in education schools, the amount of equipment that's necessary is far less. Students largely pay their own way, and professors make lower salaries.
So, how would this change?
There are several things that are happening right now. One is, we are doing two things with regard to teacher education. And I should say this, all the social institutions in America, to some extent, are broken right now. We're going through this period of dramatic demographic, economic, technological, and global change. And every one of our social institutions is created for a different time. So we sort of look at them and we say, God, government isn't working as well as it used to work. Healthcare isn't what we need it to be. Media isn't what we'd like it to be. And look at those financial institutions, they're a wreck. And so what we're doing with each one of them, where possible, is we're simultaneously trying to reform it and replace it. So what's happening with teacher education are really two things. Thing number one is that we're seeing a lot of alternative providers, which is fairly technical to say that. A lot of organizations that haven't traditionally been in the business of preparing teachers are entering the field. Some are for-profit, some are not-for-profit. Teacher America has been a major provider of teachers. We're seeing school districts prepare their own teachers. We're seeing programs like Knowledge is Power, KIPP, mm-hmm. which is a school system, prepare their own teachers. And given all that, what we're doing is giving education schools competition. And we're also seeing money and incentives. For example, the Secretary of Education just proposed a program which would identify the best teacher education programs in the country and provide support to those programs. By doing that, we'll also be identifying those that don't perform as well. There are some amazing teacher education programs in America, even if there are weak ones, many weak ones. There are also some excellent models to learn from. One of my favorites is the University of Indianapolis, in which they've done away with courses and turned them into modules, which they've embedded in the clinical experience. The end result is that what students see in the classroom at school tomorrow is what they learned about in their academic classes the afternoon before. There's never been a closer tying of theory and practice than I've seen there, nor have I seen better uses of university professors and teachers. And then there's some extraordinary programs around the country. Stanford has an excellent program. University of Virginia has a strong program. Boston College has a strong program. There are also at universities that aren't nationally known. Alverno College in Milwaukee has a wonderful program, and so does Emporia State University in Kansas. So that it doesn't need to be one of the best nationally known institutions in the country to be strong. And by the way, University of Michigan is developing some extraordinary practices which I think are going to be adopted around America.
Mm-hmm. So do you think in the common element of all these strong programs is the close connection between what's learned in the classroom and what they see in practice?
Each of these programs has a really strong sense of what a teacher needs to know and be able to do. Their curriculums mirror that. They have a very strong tie between theory and practice, what they're taught in the university and what they see in the classroom and do in the classroom. They provide constant feedback to students of high quality. They have faculty are intimately involved in the schools, and school teachers are intimately involved in universities, and they have high standards of graduation.
What do you think about the Department of Education's influence right now? I think there are three ways in which they wanted to judge programs.
Mm-hmm. The Department of Education in the Obama administration has focused on raising standards, common standards. What they've also focused on is data, accountability, outcomes, pay for performance, charter schools. Now, we used to have a name for people who had policies like that. We call them Republicans. What's happened is education may be one of the only areas in the entire country right now in which there's a bipartisan coalition. And it's not they've necessarily come together politically, but they have reached the same conclusions about what's necessary for teachers and for measuring the quality of education. So I strongly support the Duncan Plan, and I strongly support the kinds of changes that would be required in terms of data, in terms of outcomes, in terms of accountability. It's where we need to go. And I applaud the administration for taking these steps. What they're doing now is offering carrots to institutions. And I think institutions need to respond now to the carrots, because the next step is going to be the sticks.
I think one of their requirements is looking at how many students begin a program and how many students come out of the program. Do you worry that that might be corrupting?
I worry more about this. At the moment, 50% of the people who finish teacher education programs never become teachers. And that's a lot of money to spend, and it has dramatic impact on standards. If we're preparing twice the number we actually need, plus we have a glut, once the 50% still enter the market.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pairing at least twice as many as we need. We could be far more selective. And if one adds the other piece, which is being required, which is how successful are the teachers in enhancing student learning in their classes, institutions can't graduate more lower quality people and expect to excel on the other standard.
What I'm still not clear about is if it really pays to bring in so many students, how are you going to cut the financial benefits to an institution so that they graduate fewer teachers?
We don't need to bring in as many teachers. We don't need to bring in as many candidates, and thereby we can be far more selective.
Well, except that you were saying that it really pays them to bring in more students, because I myself wonder whether the reason for graduating so many teachers was demand for teachers. I kind of wonder about that. I think that there's often been a glut of teachers, and that actually it's paying the universities, as you said. It was cash cow. So I'm not clear how you take away that incentive.
States. At the moment, we're not only preparing too many teachers, we're also preparing them in fields we don't need them. So the largest surplus in teachers in the country is elementary education, and the largest production by universities is elementary education. That doesn't make any sense at all. States have the capacity in funding universities to talk about numbers. They also have the capacity to talk about fields. Departments of education have a major role here. Higher education, people are called state higher education executive officers. People who head the higher education systems in different states have the capacity to do that. There are all kinds of levers that can be pushed to make this better.
So it sounds as though you're pretty hopeful about what you see for the future of teacher preparation.
I'm very, very hopeful. What I don't know is, and nobody knows, what shape it's going to take. Is it going to remain largely universities, which I hope it will, but universities have to improve to make that possible? Is it going to be a mixture of universities and all the other providers that have entered the field? Or is it going to be largely the other providers? Nobody knows the answer to that question yet.
Thank you, Arthur. We've been talking to Arthur Levine of the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship Foundation. Our topic today has been teacher education. For more information about this series, go to our website at examineducation.org. Our website also provides links to other sites that include additional details about the issues raised by each guest. We welcome your suggestions for future topics and your comments about what you heard today, so go to our website or follow us on Facebook, Examining Education. Today's program was produced with help from Managing Editor Jason Croft and audio support from Mike Pritchard. I'm the host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. This is Examining Education.